Malik Books. I'm Malik from Malik Books, your community bookstore specializing in African American books and gifts full of cultural diversity. The total African American experience that brings the world together. MalikBooks.com, your place to shop for books. MalikBooks.com. Malik Books is what you
need. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is KBLA Talk 1580. Our phone number 1-800-920-1580. 1-800-920-1580. In this hour, as a marginalized student, boarding school was supposed to be the opportunity of a lifetime for Kendra James, a world-class education, the space and resources of a small college, and a close-knit community, all in one perfect package. Well, it didn't quite turn out that way. Once Kendra actually inhabited a space that was never built for her, the experience would prove to be anything but an educational panacea. Kendra James discusses all of that in this hour. Her book is called Admissions, A Memoir of Surviving Boarding School. I am pleased to welcome her in studio. For those of you who are watching our live stream, you can see Kendra right now. Kendra James, I see you too. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you in studio. Thanks for coming down to see us. And thank you for the hour. A lot to talk about with regard to your experience at boarding school, something that I know a lot of parents these days, certainly African-American parents, consider as one option. There's so many options. Now, there's public school, of course. There's private school. There's boarding school. There's homeschooling. So many options for parents to choose these days what they think is best for how to educate their particular child or children, and even children in the same family don't access the same ways to being educated. Parents have to make choices for each individual child, which I understand and, of course, appreciate. But let's talk about your story, though, and how you got on the boarding school track. Before I get to that level of detail, just tell me about where you grew up, about your backstory, and why boarding school even became an option for your parents.
Yeah, totally. So I'm from a small town outside of New York City in New Jersey called Maplewood. Mm-hmm. My house was actually kitty corner to Newark and Irvington. Mm-hmm. It's a small town, about, 25,000 people, and was considered in its day really diverse. Mm-hmm. So I grew up going to the public schools there through I went church preschool and then to public school, elementary and middle. But boarding school for me, I went to the Taft School, mm-hmm, in Connecticut, and boarding school was always a known option because my dad actually went there, mm-hmm, in the 1970s and he graduated in 1974. He was very involved in the school. He was very involved in alumni culture, all of that stuff. So we were up there quite often, mm-hmm, whether it was just for alumni weekends or eventually he was on the board of trustees. So we were up there for stuff like new ice skating rinks opening, all of that, mm-hmm, kind of stuff. And then during middle school, I actually had my first admissions interview with a guy who had been the director of admissions, I believe, when my dad had attended.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was always sort of in the back, on the back burner, sort of simmering within the family. Mm. I went to my public high school for my first year, for ninth grade, just because I had been going to school with the same people since I was five.
Sure.
And you sort of have that idea of what your high school experience is going to be like. You really want to do it with those people. So I went. I had that experience, and sort of the first story in the book describes why I kind of, I knew kind of very quickly it was time to fly the coop and go try something else.
Go ahead and unpack, yeah, it right quick. We got the hour.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. So it was Columbia High School, great school. Mm-hmm. Gave us people like Lauryn Hill, SZA went there, Zach Braff, it's a good, good school. But for me, I needed smaller class sizes. I needed the attention that you can get at a school like Taft. And also, sort of the deciding factor for me was there was a fight one day. It was off campus. Mm-hmm. We were at lunch at a pizzeria, and two girls got into a huge fight, jumped on top of our table. The table collapsed on top of me and my friends. And that was just kind of the moment I knew. I was like, I'm not cut out for this.
Mm-hmm. That would get my attention, too. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so I had already applied. But when the package came in the mail, the acceptance letter, I was like, all right, it's time to do this. We can go for sophomore year. And that's what we did. I switched out. And the first day of school sophomore year was sometime early September, my parents drove me up there.
Yeah. I'm fascinated first by your father, because your father, I assume, was a black man.
Yes.
Okay. He goes to this private boarding school, Taft, as a African-American male in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You see where I'm going with this story.
Yep.
And, of course, you talk about some of this in your text. But give me a better understanding of how your father processed his journey. This is rare, you know, for a black family to have, you know, multiple generations going to boarding schools. It's not a story you read every day. We all go to public schools, but it's not a story you read every day, which I wanted to talk to you about, two or three generations in a particular family, a black family, going to a private boarding school. Your father, though, again, goes there as a black male in the early 70s. Now, I can take something away from what you've already teed up and what's in your book about how that experience shaped him, because he goes on to become a member of the Board of Trustees. He's very involved. He's one of the most active alumni. So he obviously enjoyed his experience at some level to want to stay involved all these years later. But give me some insight as to how he navigated that as a black male in the early 70s.
Yeah, so I think also to understand, so he was from Chicago. He's from the south side of Chicago. So
all the more reason why.
Yep.
I'm trying to understand how this worked. Yeah.
So I don't know quite how he found it, but I know that at some point he found the program ABC, right. A Better Chance.
Sure.
And that's how he got from the south side up to Watertown, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, he actually ended up going to Brown. And as I understand it, he went back to the south side not as often, as that journey, that sort of educational journey was happening. So it's interesting. His experience, he obviously did have a great time. There's a quote from him in an alumni magazine that came out, I think it was my junior or senior year, where he says, I had such a great experience here. I would not have sent my daughter if I did not have that kind of experience. And I think that part of it, and like you said, we have the hour. I think part of it is that for black boys, and I'm seeing this a lot as I go talk to kids at boarding schools right now, black boys have always had a slightly easier experience at these schools. Not a smooth sail by any means, but definitely easier than black girls. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that in pop culture, in the society around us, we are taught that things like, you know, excelling at sports, being, you know, involved. We see black men excelling at sports, excelling in pop culture, music, that area. So there is something, and always has been, even back in the 70s, you think about the stuff that was popular then. There has always been something that tells white kids that black men to some degree are cool, even if we can't, you know, even if they are not to be socialized with necessarily at a one-on-one basis. There is something, there's an aura of coolness there that I think makes it easier, especially if they confirm some of those stereotypes that white people are expecting to see, you know, are good at sports, are entertaining on the dance floor, stuff like that. It makes it easier for them to mesh in socially. Now, the other thing I'll say is that my dad was there at a very specific time. He was there from 70 to 74. 1971 was the first year that Taft allowed women in. So black kids, not a lot of black kids, had been going to the school since 1954. Women showed up in 71. And so instead of blackness being the novelty, women were the novelty on campus.
All right, hold that thought. I see. This is getting rich. This is getting good. So there are a number of things to interrogate. One, what happens when women show up?
Yep.
Number one. Number two, I know this program, ABC, A Better Chance. I know a number of black men my age and even older who experienced the opportunity to go to great schools. A friend of mine named Sylvester Monroe comes to mind. Went on to be a great writer for Time Magazine, one of their best. Sylvester, from the south side of Chicago, had a chance to go to a private boarding school because of this program, A Better Chance, that gives black boys around the country an opportunity to get out of the neighborhoods oftentimes that they're in and go to great schools and their careers. Sylvester went on to Harvard, like your dad went on to Brown. So I know this program. I celebrate it. It's done wondrous things over the years. And yet, while your father enjoyed his experience, not so much for Kendra, and we'll talk about that when we move forward in this hour. You're listening to Kendra James on KBLA Talk 1580.
This is KBLA Talk 1580, where hate loses and love wins.
Continuing our conversation now with our guest in studio, Kendra James, about her book, Admissions, a memoir of surviving boarding school. You were telling us the story before that break about your father having gone there in the 70s, but in 71, for the first time ever, women show up. And we'll talk about your story as a black woman showing up many, many years later. But what did you learn in your research? Or what did your father say to you about what happened when women writ large showed up, never mind their race, color, or creed, in 1971 at Taft?
It's really interesting. I've been learning things like throughout the process of like, even now the book is out, I'm done. I'm still picking things up. I was actually just at a, it was the 40th anniversary of this program, United Cultures at Taft, which is one of the sort of affinity spaces that isn't just for one race. It's for everyone to sort of gather and learn about people. And they showed this picture from the old Black Student Union. I forget exactly what it was called, but it was a Black Student Union that was then turned into more of a mixed group. And it's, my dad is in the picture. I think it's like five Black men and then a few of the women who had shown up. Mm-hmm. And then one white woman on the call revealed, because we were all on a Zoom talking about this group, and she revealed, I was actually underneath the table, which actually told me a lot about sort of the solidarity that I kind of assume must have existed in some ways between these women who were also in their way like marginalized a little bit on this campus. The school been all male since the 1890s when it was founded. And so it was really interesting to learn that there was some solidarity between these groups. Because for me, jumping like ahead into the future, when I got there in 2003, solidarity between the Black students and white women or white girls on campus, that was not a thing. Mm-hmm. We didn't see that at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was a really interesting and transformative time for the school because this was completely new. And they were not the first of the boarding schools to do it, of the New England boarding schools, but they were definitely early.
Yeah. How do you, let me just switch gears here. I shouldn't say switch gears. Let me pivot ever so gently here because I'm fascinated by the way you view, because I have my own take on this, but this is your conversation, how you view these sort of affinity groups in not at just places like Taft, but across the country. As this country becomes more populated by people of color, you have these persons who want to, in the name of solidarity and coalition building, sort of morph all these groups together. And my sense of it is that our demands and our grievances and our issues as black people are dramatically different, uniquely different than anybody else. So I'm all for solidarity. I'm all for coming together. I'm all for kumbaya when and where we can. But this amorphous sort of, you know, blending of all these groups, these affinity groups together, it cuts both ways for me. I don't want to color it much more than that because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to jump ahead of your response. But how do you read those kinds of efforts to form these, you know, broad kumbaya groups, if I can put it this way, in places and spaces that you've occupied?
Let me tell you, I love an affinity group. Yes. I think they're great. And I did not realize the value of an affinity group when I got to Taft, because I kind of resisted joining one for a really long time. Because like I said, I grew up in a really diverse town. My friends were a regular sort of like United Bennington, Bennington color. And when I got to Taft, I really did not think that that was a space that I needed. And part of that was because of the way like I had been raised like with quite a few respectability politics, which I also talk about in the book. And I think that just comes from, we lived in an upper middle class community. My dad was a banker. We were in a single income household. My mom stayed at home. And so we had sort of all those trappings of like the upper middle class that I think two people who were born, you know, right as Brown versus the Board of Education was passed, like, and grew up within the civil rights movement. I think that's, you know, that's what they were aiming for. That's what they were striving for, that come up. And so I grew up with a lot of like, we don't listen to XYZ, you know, my brother, you know, could never have his pants sagging, like all of that stuff. And I was told that kids who like maybe didn't speak like I did or use vernacular, like, those kids are not as smart as you. They might be bad. Also, we had leveling systems in my original public school. So you could be in level 2, 3, or 4. Now, of course, the ACLU did an investigation into our school system. And it was definitely proven that it was harder for a white kid to drop a level than it was for a black kid to come up a level. So the classes were pretty segregated. And so I took all of that knowledge and went to Taft with it. And then I got up there for the students of color orientation, which I, again, had sort of like my feathers were a little ruffled by thinking that I had to go to that. Mm-hmm. And I got in there and I felt like so out of place immediately, because here all of these kids were. These were the kids. They sounded like the kids I had been told that I shouldn't be associating with. They were dressed like kids I had told like I shouldn't be associating with. And so it took me a long time to start like deconstructing a lot mm-hmm. of the stuff that I had grown up with. And just like learning how to live in an affinity space. And now, so then I went to college and I wasn't super involved in affinity spaces there. However, once I left college and got back into into sort of like the working world, mm-hmm. the corporate world, mm-hmm. let me tell you, like an affinity group is one of my favorite things. We have one at my current job now. I actively looked for one when I was at like CBS Viacom. I think that they are really, really beneficial, even if they don't enact change necessarily. It's just amazing for me to have a place to vent, to yeah. say like, did you hear what happened in this meeting? Mm-hmm. Can you believe X, Y, Z, you know?
To make sure we're not two ships passing yeah. in the night. Let me be clear about what I was saying. Mm-hmm. I support and believe in affinity groups as well myself, so long as they're not amorphous. That is, I'm not down with all of these, you know, BIPOC groups,
yes.
these people of color groups. I mean, that's because again, the struggles that we face and yeah. what we're up against are so uniquely different than what other people encounter and what they endure. So I was just making the point. I think we're on the same page.
Yeah, okay. and I am speaking specifically yeah. about like a black student
there
union,
we go.
A
there
black
we go.
Affinity group. There oh yeah, go. Yeah, 100%.
I just want to make sure you're on the same page about that. I was like, maybe she didn't understand my point, and maybe I wasn't clear in what I was saying. Could have been my fault. But we're on the same page now. So thank God for Jesus on that. let me move on now to this notion of how one holds on to one's blackness. You made it very clear that you ran into a bunch of people who you were told sort of not to be like. You've been spending your entire childhood trying to present in a particular and a peculiar way. Now you show up at this school with other black folk, but they are exactly what you were told you didn't want to be like. And so it raises the question, raises a bunch of questions, but one of the questions for me is, how does one go about holding on? And I had this conversation with my friend Sylvester, who I mentioned earlier, who went to a boarding school in New England, out of Chicago, Southside, because of this program, ABC, a better chance, like your father took advantage of. But it raises questions for me. How does a black kid from the Southside of Chicago, or a black kid from your neighborhood in New Jersey, for that matter, hold on to his or her blackness, whatever they've defined that to be at the age of 17 or 18? It's a journey, right? But at 17 or 18, you have some sense of what your blackness is and that of the friends that you hang out with. How do you hold on to that when you end up at a New England boarding school?
And that's where I think for me, that's where our black affinity group, it defaulted to being black and Latinx. It mm-hmm. was supposed to be more inclusive. It was called the Taft Afro-Latina Asian Student Alliance, TALSA. But we didn't have a lot of Asian kids join mm-hmm. us. So it was mostly just black and Latinx and like a lot of Afro-Latina mm-hmm. Or Afro-Latinx students. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was actually where I learned how in some ways to like define my blackness, because prior to that it had been defined in that very sort of like the Banks family mm-hmm. from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air,
sure.
like sort of like that sure. That archetype. And for me, it was really important to be in that space at the age I was there from 15 to 18. Mm-hmm. And to be in that space at that time was really important for me, because it taught me that there is no specific way to be black. Mm-hmm. And to there's a writer, Jean Demby, who I love, who always talks about if you were one of those kids who was told like, oh, you speak too white, or that you say things like they bullied me because I do my homework, all of that stuff. I think I was sort of in that mindset, but being there let me know. It's like, no, I was just stuck up. No, mm-hmm. I was just being like snotty. There was no there is no one way to be black. What there is a way to gather and support mm-hmm. other people who look like mm-hmm. you, and you don't need to be acting, looking, dressing, sounding in like one way in order to do that.
Yeah. Were any of your black friends, did any of your black friends back at home before you go to Taft end up in any way sort of ridiculing you or dismissing you Did it fray any of your friendships because you went to a boarding school?
Not really. It was the main question that I always got, and the story is in the book too. It was more like, what did you do? Mm-hmm. Because the question of being sent to boarding school, it sounded like people thought
you're being punished.
Exactly. And so the question I always got was like, what did you do?
Right.
What? How much trouble are you in?
Mm-hmm.
Because no one really, I had a lot of friends who would leave, there are certain exit years from a public school, like mm-hmm. fifth grade, eighth grade. And so I did have a lot of friends who would leave and go to like a private or an independent school in our area. But I was the first one who like left the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I think triggered like some, oh, she must be in a mm-hmm. heap of trouble
mm-hmm.
things for people. So I didn't really get a lot of that because they didn't understand where I was going.
Yeah. So let me advance the story. I'm looking at my clock here. I got traffic, news, and sports about 2 minutes, but we can get this started and continue on the other side of that. So what your book really lays out, it's called Admissions, A Memoir of Surviving Boarding School. That subtitle pretty much tells you that it wasn't a grand experience that you survived boarding school. Let me start with this question, and we'll build from here. When did you know, after arriving at TAF, that this journey was going to not be what you thought it was going to be?
Pretty much, I would say winter, early spring mm-hmm. of my sophomore year, which was my first year there.
Mm-hmm.
So like once we got to that point, I knew pretty quickly. And it really is. Actually, even we could go back to November when my friends told me for the first time, your roommate's racist.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of like helped me figure things out. She didn't like the way my hair product smelled. She didn't mm-hmm. like the way the room smelled after I would like flat iron my hair. I had a perm back then, like mm-hmm. a lot of us did. We got into a lot of fights about that. And then I pretended to be a witch and pretended to hex her out of the room, by which I really mean I just like set up a bunch of witchcraft looking stuff and scared her when she mm-hmm. got back from field hockey practice.
So you retaliated?
Yes. Yeah. And she was no longer my roommate after that day, and she left the school a few weeks later. But so that was the first sort of incident. But the major, major incident was when a student actually accused me of stealing from her. And I ended up having to go through what we call honor court in the boarding school world. And that was sort of when she threatened to involve the police. And that was the moment when I definitely knew like, oh, this experience is going to be wildly different, A, than what I thought, and B, than what I had been prepared for.
We're going to come right back to that because that, again, is a critical moment in the book. And I really want to hear the story. I want the audience to hear the story. And then, of course, I want to, after they hear the story, ask the obvious question, which is how your daddy processed that, how your father processed that. Here's a school that he loves and has been involved with since he finished in the early 70s. He's on the board of trustees at this school. All this stuff he's doing, he encourages his daughter to go to this boarding school, Taft, in New England. And you get there, and before you get settled, basically, you're being accused of thievery. A lot to talk about as we continue this conversation with Kendra James. Her book is called Admissions, A Memoir of Surviving Boarding School. You're listening to Kendra James on KBLA Talk 1580.
Say the quiet part out loud. KBLA Talk 1580.
Malik Books. I'm Malik from Malik Books, your community bookstore specializing in African-American books and gifts full of culture diversity, the total African-American experience that brings the world together. MalikBooks.com, your place to shop for books. MalikBooks.com.
Malik Books is what you need.
Find a righteous rage and don't be afraid to say what you see. We're KBLA Talk 1580.
I'm Tavis Smiley. She is Kendra James. You are you, and you are listening to KBLA Talk 1580. Our phone number, 1-800-920-1580, 1-800-920-1580. So glad to have you hanging out with us in this hour as we talk to Kendra James about her book, Admissions, A Memoir of Surviving Boarding School. So I asked you before news, traffic, and sports, when did you know that this was not going to be the journey that you thought it was going to be, particularly after your father had gone there in the early 70s and had such a great time as a black man out of the south side of Chicago at this boarding school in New England? This was not going to be your experience. And I ask you when you knew that, and you said when you were accused of stealing. So tell me the story, Kendra James.
Yeah, so there was another girl in our dorm. We lived in a freshman-sophomore dorm, all girls. And there was another girl there who we were friendly-ish. We hung out a few times, and I would hang out in her room occasionally, like after study hall. But yeah, she one day accused me of stealing $20 from her room. And it basically, I should set up first, Taft has something called an honor code. So we would have to sign on all of our papers or tests, "I pledge my honor that I have neither given nor received aid on this exam." And the honor code governed academic stuff, but then it also governed campus life. So this was a really hard habit to break, actually. I could just leave my laptop anywhere on campus. I would leave it in a hallway, like on a ledge. I would leave my backpack someplace else, like in the dining hall. And I knew that I could come back even 24 hours later and that like laptop would still be there because the honor code just sort of governed everything and ensured that things ran smoothly. So when you are accused of an honor code violation, that is taken extremely seriously. And basically the sort of understood rule is if you tell the truth, then you will immediately, without any going through any rigmarole, then you will basically just get like a suspension or maybe Sunday study halls, stuff like that. But if you deny or tell an outright lie, and then it is decided that you actually did the thing that you are accused of, that's considered strike two, at which point you are really risking an expulsion. So basically what happened was this girl, she accused me. She told me that she was going to give me a chance to admit to it before she went to an adult. And then she told me that and I never found out whether this was true or not. We never talked again after this incident. She told me that she had a relative in a local-ish police department, that she was going to lift my prints out of her room and give them to this relative so that they could ID them. And so when you hear that as like a 16-year-old, I don't know how any of this stuff worked. So I was just kind of, I was a kid who had once, you know, you put a fingerprint on something and then you're a kid and you try to lift it up and you think you can do all that stuff. So I got really scared in that moment, and I already knew that she had been to an adult to talk to them about it. And so when the dean of students like pulled me into his office to have this conversation, he was really talking about it as if it was already decided. Like it was, you did this, you stole this, all of this sort of like very imperative language. And knowing that she had told me that like she had this police officer relative that she was going to go to, in that moment, because my dad had gone to the school, because you sort of go off to a place like this, I think you hear this whether you're going to the supermarket or to church or to a fancy school, it's like, don't embarrass me in this space, you know, keep your hands in your pocket, do whatever you need to do to like make it through. So I'm sitting here feeling like I'm on the brink of an expulsion. And so in that moment, I had to make a calculation of like, okay, I know how the rules at this place work. I know what I can do to keep my head down and keep it moving. And what that was to admit to having stolen this girl's money. Because to me, it really sounded like this decision had already been made. So when you admit to something like that, you still have to go through this system that they call the honor court, which I think is like this panel of eight, maybe seniors and teachers. I forget exactly who's on it. But then you have your advisor and then a student advocate who stands up for you. And I like could not even tell you who my student advocate was at this point. I know it was a white girl. I know we were not friends. And then my advisor was the one black adult on campus at the time, in like an administrative or teaching capacity. And so you go to honor court, they ask you if you're going to admit what you did, and I admitted it again. And I did that so that I could get just the week suspension and then come back, finish out school, and like hopefully, fingers crossed, like not have this affect me in the future. Now, when I say affect me, I'm talking about sort of, you know, the college stuff.
Sure,
it's
on your record. Yeah,
the job stuff. Sure. I was not thinking about like psychologically, and it actually kind of turned out like neither were my parents. I think if this sort of thing happens to a kid at an independent school right now, even if it gets to the point where the kid is taking a suspension and saying that and admitting to something that they didn't do, if your kid gets sent home from school on a suspension from a boarding school, which a boarding school becomes your whole life, like you are in a bubble. That is your home. That's where you live. That's where you socialize. And to have that bubble like punctured really abruptly and dramatically, that's a shaking of a world for a teen that can be like akin to some like a minor trauma. And my parents never sent me to like any kind of therapy. They never had me talk to an adult about what had happened. And so I wasn't thinking about that part of it. I was just thinking about like, oh my gosh, college, jobs, internships, all that stuff.
When did your parents find out? And please don't tell me it's when the book came out. Although it may have been, I doubt it. Tell me when your parents found out, though, that you admitted to something that you had not done.
Here's the thing. It was when the book came out.
Because I knew you were going to say that.
I shouldn't say it wasn't when the book came out. Yeah. It was when I was in the – when you write a book like this, you got to talk to family members.
I've been there.
Yeah, who are going to be mentioned in it. I think I called my mom from the dog park, and the way I brought it up with her at first was, hey – when this administrator talked to you about what had happened, did he at all mention that the police were threatened to be involved? And she said, no. And that was sort of my first sign of like, oh, okay, so nothing, like there was a disconnect here from the administration to me and then to the information getting to my parents.
How did your parents process? They know you better than anybody in the world. Mm-hmm. They brought you in the world. How did they process that Kendra, who they knew, again, intimately well, was admitting to something that was so far away from the Kendra they knew? Your father had to have a sense of a level of embarrassment, humiliation, because he had gone to this school. His daughter's there. She's accused of thievery, and she cops to it. She admits it. Like, just take a second. How did your parents process you admitting to something that is really out of character for the Kendra that they had, you know, that they had raised?
Well, that's the thing. I think that they didn't think it was that out of character, because when you're in middle school, here's the thing. Every kid goes through a little bit of a klepto phase. That is just something that happens. Like when you're a preteen.
I like that phrase. Yeah. We all go through a klepto phase, a klepto phase. Okay, I like it. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so like I did that in middle school, of course. Right. Like I took quarters out of a giant fish bowl jar to like get comic books and like Starbucks after school. So I think they thought that that was just like a natural evolution of like that behavior. And so they were willing to believe it and to go along with it, especially since I had admitted to it. And then I came home for the week or the week and a half, whatever it was. Yeah. And I was incredibly well behaved. I like did all, they give you all your homework. Sure, you come home and do all that. And then I went back to school, and that was the spring of 2004, because it was the back half of my sophomore year. And truly, we never spoke about it again. Yeah. It never came up.
How did you process all these years of having admitted to something that got you in some trouble, but you knew then, and you knew all the years subsequent, that you had not done this? How did you limit yourself?
Truly, it was my family, and I found this out, like, I knew this, and then I also, like, saw it happen again when my parents were getting divorced. Mm-hmm. My family was not a therapy family. Like, we were not at all, and I firmly believe, like, if I ever did choose to send my child, especially a black girl, to one of these schools, even an independent day school, I would make sure she's in therapy. And I tell kids and administrators at these schools this all the time. It's not about going to therapy because something like this, like the situation that we're talking about, has happened. It's about getting them into therapy so that if something like this does happen, they have built the trust with another adult to talk about it and to parse through it. Because I didn't start talking to anyone about this until I realized I was sort of on the precipice of selling this book, because I wrote the proposal. I'm sure you know all about this. So I was working on the proposal, and then suddenly things started moving really quickly. Like we were meeting with publishers, we were talking about selling this book, and I was like, oh, if I'm actually going to write more than, you know, the two pages that I put in the proposal of this story, I need to be talking to someone about this, or it's going to be upsetting.
All right. When we come forward, speaking of upsetting, you got me upset. I'm upset. I'm upset that you copped to something that you didn't do and live with it all these years, and your mom and daddy didn't find out that you hadn't done it until the book is about to drop, about to publish. And I want to know the obvious question when we come forward. How did your mother and father respond and react when they discovered all these years later that you had admitted to something, to stealing a white girl's money, and you had never done it? Our guest is Kendra James. She's on KBLA Talk 15.
Malik Books. I'm Malik from Malik Books, your community bookstore specializing in African-American books and gifts full of culture diversity, the total African-American experience that brings the world together. MalikBooks.com, your place to shop for books. MalikBooks.com.
Malik Books is what you need.
Getting your assumptions and expanding your inventory of ideas. Let's get back to Tavis Smiley on KBLA Talk 1580.
I've said many times, sometimes the best part of these shows is in the breaks, and I try not to do that because it's hard to reprise it on the air. But Kendra and I were just talking about the one time in my life, and for those who read my memoir, you know the story of my having been accused of something when I was a 12-year-old kid that I didn't do. It fundamentally changed my life, and I am where I am today because I had to go through this ugly experience of being accused of something and being punished for something that I didn't do. The problem with me was, in that moment, nobody asked me, did you do it? The punishment was swift and certain and severe, landed me in the hospital for 10 days, but nobody ever stopped to ask me, Tavis, did you do this thing of which you were accused? If I'd been asked, I would have told them, no, I didn't. And so it threatened to destroy my own family for years until we finally had to get past that. So having said to you now on the radio what I said to Kendra during that commercial break as we were talking, I want to ask Kendra this question, which is, years later, when your book is about to drop, Admissions, A Memoir of Surviving Boarding School is the name of the book, how did your parents process you telling them, you know, I really didn't do that, I just did it to get out of the trouble that I thought was coming my way?
I think they were sad, and I think too that there might have been some realization of the way that the school framed things, not only in that moment, like when the situation was happening, but also, so my mom just sold her house. So of course I, you know, got the box of every school paper I've ever had. And I was going through a lot of like the teacher reports and the reports that you get from your advisor and your class dean. And one of them had written directly the year after the incident, or the summer, going into the summer after the incident, they wrote, you know, she came back and seemed remarkably self-centered for someone who had just gone through all that. And just like sort of the way these people were describing me, like coming off of that incident, I think also must have shaped the way they responded to it, because it was not in a sympathetic way. It was not the way that I, when I worked in education, would have dealt or would have written about a child who had just gone through something like that. And that really, when I read that, that really struck me and helped me understand the reaction then and the reaction of when I told them. Because I think that especially my mom, I think like was definitely just like very sad that she had not realized, because I didn't realize this when I was younger, like she didn't like going up there, she didn't like that environment. So I think there was a lot of that.
Yeah. When you were talking just now, my mind went, and I think you'd appreciate my point, my mind went to New York City, specifically to the Central Park Five. You know the story well. And our society has a way of coercing people who look like you and me into copping to things, into admitting to doing things that we know we didn't do. In your case, you got the punishment that came with it, but you weren't expelled, so you at least got over that hurdle. In the case of the Central Park Five, they end up going to prison. And it's not until years later where we discover the real truth that the Central Park Five were innocent. They were never guilty of what they copped to, because of the pressure they were under from law enforcement. As you well know, this happens across the country all the time. So in our remaining moments when we come forward, I want to ask you what your takeaway has been as a black woman, as a human being, as a child of God. What's your takeaway been looking back on this seminal moment in your life where you admitted to doing something that you did not do, particularly in the broader context of how that just maims emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, how it maims black people when we end up admitting to things that we know we didn't do, but we're just trying to save our hides, as it were. Yeah, Kendra James on KBLA Talk 1580.
Let's unpack a little bit more with Tavis Smiley. The conversation continues right now. Right now.
I was telling Kendra during that break, the reason why I fight so hard now, and I will not abide anybody lying on me in my career, professionally, or my personal life. You cannot ever think you're going to parse your lips to lie on me and get away with it. But I feel so viscerally about that because I was lied on as a 12-year-old kid, and it fundamentally changed my life. So you were lied on, but you copped to the lie. What have you learned over the years about not admitting to things, not copping to things that you didn't do?
Yeah, I mean, it really helped me find, if not the voice that I have now, it helped me find a voice that suited me for the time. And it was at least something that I could develop. It also, like, frankly, really opened my eyes. Like, that was the moment when I realized, oh, things are different for certain people than they are for mm-hmm. other people. And that continued, like, to show itself each year that mm-hmm. I was at Taft. There were incidents that really proved and teased that out. And then when I graduated, what it did for me was I became as as involved, I would say, or visible at the school as my dad was.
Okay.
When I was living on the East Coast, I would go back. I would always make sure that I was visible because a lot of mm-hmm. Black kids and Latinx kids did not ever come back. And so for alumni weekends. Mm-hmm. So alumni weekend would come around. We'd be outside like looking around at everyone, only white people and mm-hmm. like maybe a smattering of Black people. And what I realized was that as bad as my incident was, there were kids, I had somehow managed to like come over it. I could talk about it, or at least bury it down deep mm-hmm. enough where it wasn't bothering me. But there are kids to this day, I sit on Zooms with them sometimes, who they talk about experiences that they had at Taft, and they cry. Like, mm-hmm. I'm sitting on Zooms watching, especially Black girls, cry. And what I realized was that my trauma, though it was a trauma, was not so bad that I can't go back and be present for the kids who are there. And I fully respect and understand that there are people who can't do that.
Yeah.
But because I can, I find it very important to do so.
I got a tight 2 minutes here. As I said earlier, the book, Admissions, a memoir of surviving boarding school, is chock full of stories that made it difficult for you to survive. In 30 seconds, tee up the third big story that we didn't get to. Just tee it up right quick.
Our senior year, a girl wrote an article in the school paper that was adult supervised about how it was the Black and Latinx students' faults that the campus was as segregated as it was because we self-segregated and made white students, including this white girl, feel deeply uncomfortable of being in the space of a school that was founded by the president, a president's brother in the 1890s, but we were the problem.
No, I get it. Just wanted to tee that up for those who will want to read this book, Admissions, a memoir of surviving boarding school. Let me close quickly with this question, the exit question for this 30 seconds that remain. Would you, like your father did with you, recommend send your child to Taft?
I will not send my child to any school that I cannot be at within 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Nicely put. Very nicely put. The book is called Admissions, a memoir of surviving boarding school. You heard Kendra's answer just now. We closed where we began. There's so many ways to school kids these days, public school, private school, boarding school, homeschooling. Take her answer to that question in consideration when you're figuring out which of those options is best for your child or your children. Again, her name is Kendra James. The book is called Admissions, a memoir of surviving boarding school. Kendra, thank you for the story. Thank you for your work, your witness at Taft even today. And thank you for coming in to see us.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
My pleasure. That's our show for today. Time to make room now for the KBLA Midday Money Chain. Up next, the Millionaires Roundtable with Lynn Richardson, to be followed by Ahead of the Crypto Curve with Naja Roberts. Old money, new money, it don't matter. We got you covered here on KBLA Talk 1580. Thanks for tuning in to our program today. Lord willing, back tomorrow morning to do it all over again, 9 a.m. to 12 noon. I'm Tavis Smiley. Thanks for listening. And as always, keep the faith.
I'm Malik from Malik Books, your community bookstore specializing in African-American books and gifts full of culture diversity, the total African-American experience that brings the world together. MalikBooks.com, your place to shop for books. MalikBooks.com.
Malik Books is what you need.